And you're tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM, and this is Scald's Hall here in beautiful and fairly soggy Vancouver. It's soggy in Vancouver, imagine that. It must be a first. Anyway, here at Scald's Hall, we have a fairly involved and content-heavy show for us this week, starting off with a chance to listen to, enjoy the work of, and support the work of local emergent artist Michelle Barker, who has a novel that is coming out next week. And she's already getting involved in events to promote that book, and we have an exclusive interview with her here. And that's coming up just in a moment, so let's get started here at Scald's Hall.
Awesome!
Awesome! Awesome!
Awesome! Awesome!
That is awesome!
Awesome!
Legendary!
Awesome!
Join Jason on a spiritual and musical journey to becoming relentlessly awesome every Thursday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. only on CITR. By the way, you're awesome.
You are tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM, and this is Scald's Hall with Michelle Barker. Good morning.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm great. I'm very happy to be back on the show.
Well, and it's great to have you back. So just as a brief recap, who is Michelle Barker?
Well, I'm a writer. I live in Penticton right now, but I was born and raised in Vancouver. Went to UBC a long time ago in English literature, and I'm back at UBC again now as a master's student in creative writing. I have published all sorts of different things, including poetry, creative nonfiction, short fiction, and most recently a young adult fantasy novel.
And you're here to tell us about your most recent novel, aren't you?
I am. It's called The Beggar King, and it's published by Thistledown Press. It's a fantasy novel for teens. I'm also hoping that it might get an adult audience because a third of the narration is from an adult narrator. I like to say that The Beggar King is about the underside of things. The main character, his name is Jordan Elliott, he's 15 years old, and he discovers that he has an underside. He also discovers that magic has an underside, and in the book I call that the under magic, and it's dark and dangerous and hard to get rid of once it's come into the world. So the story begins, the main setting is the city of Sir, spelled C-I-R, and there's an attack, and a lot of people are taken prisoner, including Jordan's mother. And they're taken away, and nobody knows where they're being held. At the same time, Jordan is facing a personal issue because he's 15 now. He has a year before he has to basically decide what he's going to do with the rest of his life. Because in this world, you declare your vocation when you turn 16, and there's a big ceremony where you take your robes, and the color of the robe denotes the vocation that you've chosen, or that has chosen you. And the problem for Jordan is that he doesn't think he's good at anything, and he has absolutely no idea what he's going to do. He likes to steal tomatoes, but unfortunately there aren't any robes for that. A year passes, he reaches the point where he's 16, there's been no news of his mother or anybody else, and everybody is losing hope. And on his 16th birthday, he does something stupid, which is pretty usual, I guess, for a 16-year-old boy. He breaks the law, and he humiliates a group of enemy soldiers. He's about to be caught, and if he is caught, he will be killed. And he suddenly hears a voice basically offering him the gift of disappearing. He all of a sudden knows that he can disappear, and he does it. The only little problem is that disappearing comes from the under magic, and the under magic has been banished. And so, of course, the big question is, how can he do this? He doesn't think too much about where this has come from, and that's where he really gets into trouble, because you don't get anything like that for free, and when he finds out what the price is, he's not going to want to pay.
What was the source of inspiration for this particular story?
Well, it came from a number of places, but I guess it all started a long time ago when I was asked to give a presentation at an elementary school, well, my son's elementary school, about what it was like to be a writer. The kids were so interested and so nice to me that I decided that it would be great to write for this audience. which of course is not at all how it turned out in the end, because they were like eight, and that is not what the audience is at all. When it started out, it was like this sort of adventure story for kids or something. It just wasn't working anyways. And I somehow slid into fantasy, discovered a quote from Baudelaire, which most people will probably recognize from the movie The Usual Suspects, when Kevin Spacey is talking about Kaiser Soze. And he says, "The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he doesn't exist." And when I heard that line, a little light went on. And I think that was probably the original impetus for my creating the character of the Beggar King. Because the Beggar King really functions sort of like the boogeyman. He's what you get warned about, but nobody really thinks that he's real. He's more like a story that people have made up to make sense of evil. But what I started finding with the story that I was writing is that I didn't want this to be a black and white thing, you know, this is good and that's bad, because I really believe that there is an undeniable draw to evil, and I wasn't wanting to whitewash that. And I don't think kids would want that to be whitewashed either. And so over the years of writing the book, the material got a lot darker and the narrator's age started creeping up higher and higher, and the next thing I knew, I had this fantasy novel for teens. But I also was looking at another source, I think, as well, and that would have been Carl Jung's work on the shadow archetype, because I'm very interested in this whole idea that everything has an underside. And that was, I think that more than anything, that's what has informed the book.
Can you tell us a little bit about the writing process you go through?
Well, I guess the process is more or less the same for most of my stories, but this in particular changed enormously. If you were to take the first draft and put it side by side with the published novel, you would just shake your head and you wouldn't be able to believe that one would end up turning into the other, because they're so different. I read a wonderful book by Jack Hodgins called A Passion for Narrative, and he has a chapter on revision in that book that I think is very powerful, because I think a lot of people are under the misconception that revision means moving around a couple of paragraphs and adding in a comma here and there. And what he says, and what I discovered through the writing of this book in particular, is that revision really means revision, which involves a looking anew at the work, which often also involves starting over, which I did several times. And a lot of this really evolved through feedback. I'm sure I'm not the first person to say this, but I really believe that it takes a village to write a novel. And even though that might sort of seem strange, because writing is such a solitary occupation, but so much happens through feedback. You know, if you're open enough to it and you can listen to what people are telling you about your work, you can really learn a lot. And that's what happened with this book, for sure. I had never written fantasy before, so the learning curve was huge. And I remember when I first sent off an early draft to a writer who I've gotten to know over the years, named Dave Margoshis in Saskatchewan, he sent me back 10 pages of questions, and I really think of that as my first lesson in world building, because, and I think probably people who write historical fiction would be facing the same thing, that you're faced with a setting that is not the regular world, and we take so many things for granted, such as what people eat and what they wear and how they speak, but when you're writing fantasy, all of that more or less goes out the window, and it's free reign, which is fun, but also it takes a lot of time. And I found that, of course, you can't dump all these details onto the reader. You have to weave them in. And that took me 11 years. And I think that's probably why, because it was a real complex process of figuring this all out and then trying to get it in so that the reader would actually enjoy themselves and not feel that they were being dumped on.
And just to continue that a little bit, can you tell us a little bit about the publishing process?
Well, it was a long, long road. I had an agent early on, which was very wonderful, actually. She hung with me for about 2 years, and then she threw up her hands in despair and said, "No, I can't do this anymore because it's not selling." And of course, I couldn't blame her, because agents don't get paid unless they sell your book. And so I was on my own after that. And the publishing process was very, very hard. I counted about 47 rejections. I think there might have been more. And rejection is brutal. There's no other way to put it. I mean, sometimes you send your work out and you get no response, and that's or you get a form letter, or you get not a very nice letter. I mean, I also had good things happen over the years. I had a Canada Council grant, which was very, very helpful. I had some short stories that sort of spun out of the novel that got published, and that kept me going, and that was great. But I think that the reality is that I sent the book out long before it was ready. And probably a lot of the publishers who said no to me really did me a very big favor. But it's easy to say that now because, of course, somebody did say yes. When you're in the middle of that process and you're sending your book out, A, you don't know that you're sending it out too soon, and B, you don't know that anybody is ever going to say yes. So it was tough. It definitely was. By the time Thistledown said yes, I figured, of course, that it was perfect by then. And then I got my editor assigned to me, and her name was Liz Phillips, and she was absolutely wonderful. And she worked with me for about 2 months of intense back and forth trying to figure out how to get this book better. She had a wonderful sense of humor, and she also took the time to explain the changes that she wanted made, and I really appreciated that. It almost felt like being back in school. It was great.
Now, the book is going to be available for sale soon. Where can we go to get it?
It's actually on sale already. You can get it at any Chapters or Indigo. Some independent bookstores as well are going to be carrying it. I know it's going to be an ebook. I don't know if the ebook is ready yet. I had somebody go and look for it about a week and a half ago, and he said he couldn't find it yet. But it's coming as an ebook. You can also order it online at Amazon or on the Thistledown Press website as well.
And are you going to be doing any book tours to promote it?
I am, actually. I have a launch in Penticton on April the 16th, which probably is going to be before this show airs, so that's not much help to anybody. But I also have one in Vancouver on April the 23rd, which is a Tuesday. It's at the Establishment Restaurant in Kitsilano and starts at 6:30. Everybody is welcome. The address is 3162 West Broadway, and that's between Balaclava and Trutch. I'm going to be out east in the eastern townships of Quebec. I have a launch there on May the 9th. And in Victoria, I'll be doing a reading on June the 1st at Dark Horse Books. And I'm also going to be running, actually, a workshop for younger writers, fantasy workshop, at something called the BC Youth Writers Camp, which takes place in Penticton, and that's in the first week in July.
And don't go away, everyone, because coming up in a moment, we are going to hear an exclusive sneak peek at Michelle's new novel. So stay tuned. So you're tuned.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Into CITR 101.9 FM, and we are here at Scalds Hall with Michelle Barker. Hello again.
I'm still here.
And can you tell us a little bit about what it is we are about to hear?
Yes. Well, I'm going to start with a scene that's about a third of the way through the book, but before I even talk about that, I have to explain one thing. I mentioned that the book was about the underside of things, and one thing that I did was create a couple of under animals, I'll call them. There are under cats and under rats, and anyone who writes knows that it's really a lot of fun to create characters who behave badly, and these ones, they're terrible. Sarmilion is one of the narrators, and he is the underside of cat. And so what that means is that he's human-sized, he walks around on two legs, he has quite a big mouth, a full collection of smoking jackets, and he likes to drink fireweed whiskey. He also happens to be a writer with a dark side, and I don't think that I'd probably call that a coincidence. So I'll describe the scene that I'm going to read. It comes, as I said, about a third of the way through the book. Jordan is in trouble. He's just broken the law, and he's disappeared for the first time. And he doesn't really understand yet what he's gotten himself into. He just thinks it's quite a lot of fun that he's been able to disappear. When he reappears a couple of minutes later, he does not tell Sarmilion what he's done. Sarmilion is just can't really quite figure out what's happened. But he knows that Jordan is in trouble. And so he hurries him out of town and takes him to see a notoriously foul man named Piccolo, who runs a tavern. And Jordan takes an instant dislike to Piccolo. And so that's the scene that I'm going to read to you right now. "You bring me a laddie for some work?" Piccolo pointed towards Jordan with his chin. "Or is this just nuisance I sees at my bar?" Sarmilion opened his mouth, but it was Jordan who spoke. "I won't work for you." He glared at the greasy older man. Piccolo's laugh was sharp and dangerous. "You will when you're hungry, laddie, eh, Sarmilion? We all knows what it's like to be hungry, don't we?" He winked at Jordan. "You're a proud one, are you? Just like your paps." Then he left the room, passing through the swinging doors that led into the kitchen. Jordan straightened. "What did he mean by that? That man doesn't know my father." "Piccolo knows everyone," said Sarmilion. You'd better hope your father never made an enemy of him. He keeps a ledger. A brown leather folder he calls his big books. A record of every wrong that's ever been done to him. And he pays them back, one by one. He never forgets the face of a man who's crossed him. I'm not crossing him, Jordan said. If I have to steal a tomato or two to feed myself, that's one thing, but I won't be indebted to someone like him. Sarmilion's eyebrows rose. Perhaps you don't understand the magnitude of this situation. Every Brynian landguard is hunting you down. You won't be going home for a while, maybe not a long while. Piccolo's the sort of fellow who can offer you protection. He knows the right people. He has the power to make a landguard look the other way, but he expects something in return. When he offers you work, you take it. Jordan shrugged. I won't work for him. I'm a loyalist. I plan to do something important, something glorious. He looked up to see Piccolo standing before him. A loyalist, he says. Now there's a rag. Loyalists know better than to announce themselves to the world, you damn blatherskite. You still got your slag and milk teeth. Don't worry. I'll teach you your occupation before long. He set a plate of steaming food before Jordan. There you are now. Fresh fish, bit of scrambled egg, slice of bread, fine tomatoes, on the house. Jordan didn't need anyone to tell him this meal wasn't free. It was a down payment on the job Piccolo would ask him to do as soon as he'd finished eating. I'm not hungry, he said, pushing the plate away. Piccolo's face went red. He coughed, spat onto the plate of food, then said to Sarmilion, Tell your friend he'll be paying for his meal whether he eats it or not. Sarmilion opened his velvet sack, took out a gold coin, and placed it on the bar. No, Undercat, I don't want your coin. I want his. I don't have any, said Jordan, but you already knew that. Well then, my bootless little measle, we have ourselves a problem. See, I made you a meal. I wants my coin. Come on, Piccolo, said Sarmilion. It's his birthday. A round of bloody billies for everyone. My treat. Piccolo kept his eyes trained on Jordan. Oh, he said with a smirk. 16, are you? A man now. Big man. Loyalist man. Too good for the likes of us simple folk, eh? Your mule-brained papa was the same. And that sweet young Tanny, wasn't she just smitten by the skinny carver? Never had a real man, I reckon, or she would have fancied me instead, eh? Jordan slammed his hands onto the bar. I don't need to take this from you. For an instant, he panicked. You did it once. Why not do it again? He reached behind him, pulled apart a corner of the air, and waited for the rushing sound of wings around his head. Then he stepped out of the world. If the tavern had seemed dark and dank, it was nothing compared to this echoing passageway he entered for the second time that day. He rubbed his arms to keep warm and breathed through his mouth to avoid the smell of rotting meat. Greetings, came a voice from behind him. Jordan wheeled around. There was that fellow emerging from the shadows, more like a shadow himself than a man. I see you're making good use of your gift, he said. It comes in handy, said Jordan. He tried to make sense of this new place, though the light was poor. Where are we? On the dead side of the world, of course. Don't be ridiculous, said Jordan. Only spirits walk on the dead side. Everyone knows that. Behind him, Sarmilion was dancing around in confusion as Piccolo thumped his meaty fists on the counter and yelled, Where is he? You bring that dog's body back in here and make him pay for what he done. I don't like the look of him. Got too much of his own mind and not enough respect for his elders. See? There was life. Jordan could hear it. The shadowy man was staring at him. Everyone knows the dead side is for spirits, do they? He let out a high-pitched laugh. What everyone knows is a far cry from what is, wouldn't you say? Everyone knows there's no such thing as the Beggar King. Everyone knows a boy cannot disappear. That's why no one will believe these things, even when they see them with their own eyes. They'll search for every possible explanation and deem impossible the ones that do not please them. They will believe anything except what is.
Can you tell us a little bit about the second excerpt we're about to hear?
Yeah, the second excerpt, Jordan is in trouble again. Big surprise. Now he understands what he's done by accepting this gift from the Beggar King. And he knows that he is going to have to get away from him, but he doesn't know how. What he's doing in this scene, he's had to escape from the palace. But the one thing that he cannot do anymore is disappear, because every time he disappears, the first person he runs into, of course, is the Beggar King, and he doesn't want to see him again. So what he does is borrow some robes from his girlfriend, Ophira. Now, these robes are the type that only a female seer would wear, and so they offer him a few advantages. First of all, they're respected by most Sirens. They come with a veil, which means that no one's going to be able to see him when he's walking down the street. And anybody who would see this veil would assume that it was a girl, because the seers are women, and only women who are seers wear the veil. So he figures that he's going to be more or less safe, and he's trying to get away. And in this scene, you're going to get to meet the Underats, who are pretty bad dudes. As he made his way out of the temple, there was a rumble in the sky. Enormous thunderheads had appeared above the holy city. Thunder clattered, and a bolt of lightning illuminated the night sky. A moment later, a driving rain began. The cobblestones grew so slick, Jordan slipped several times on his way down the mountain and towards the Alley of Seers. Around every corner, in every darkened doorway, he feared only one thing, that he would be there. What could the Beggar King see from his darkened path? But Jordan knew the answer to that. He saw everything. He must know Jordan was planning to defy him. The rain made the veil cling to his face. It was so uncomfortable and hard to see through now that it was wet that he almost lifted it, but stopped himself. He cannot find me. He must not. Thunder roared and lightning lit the whitewashed stone of the city with unnatural brightness. He was 15 minutes away from the Alley of Seers, almost safe. And then he rounded a corner, and there stood Piccolo, huddled with two Underats in the doorway of a smoke shop. "Oi!" called the one whom Jordan recognized as Jack-Jack. "Pretty lass, come in out of the rain." "You'll spoil your swanky veil," said Piccolo with a leer. "Now wouldn't that be a shame? We'd have to peel it off you to see what's underneath." The three of them whooped and guffawed. Clearly not everyone respected Siren tradition. Jordan kept walking, shoving his trembling mannish hands into the pockets of his robes. "Lassie," called the leather-bound rat named Marco. "Come share a glass. We got mug wine aplenty and a spare pipe of dried dung." Jordan was about to shake his head when from somewhere behind him a man said, "Greetings." His knees went weak with terror. "Don't turn around," but he couldn't stop himself. There was the Beggar King wearing deep black robes. His long hair was wet with the rain, his skin pink, his lips a living red. Jordan was stunned. He couldn't move. He knows. He had to. A simple veil, saffron robes. How could these be enough to fool a sorcerer? But the Beggar King merely smiled and said, "Forgive them their rudeness. They are not accustomed to dealing with ladies." Jordan forced his head into a bow. "Go now, get away." But he couldn't make his legs work. "He looks like that Brinian feller we was talking about before," Jack-Jack said. "Oi!" he called to the Beggar King. "You're the one what sells them little box of salty nuts, eh? We could use a little box of salty nuts right about now, eh, Marco, eh?" The Beggar King's eyes were trained on Jordan. "Might we have a word?" Jordan looked up, his entire body quivering beneath Ophira's robes. "I seek a boy by the name of Jordan Elliot." "That rascal," Piccolo grumbled. "You won't be having him, not if I gets him first." The Beggar King didn't take his eyes off Jordan. "Might you know where to find him?" Jordan shook his head. "Tell me, what is a shrouded lass doing out at this hour on such a stormy night?" Jordan cleared his throat, trying to keep himself from speaking, when someone grabbed him by the arm. "There you are," said Ophira. She faced the others. "Excuse my sister, she sleepwalks. I've been up and down the streets looking for her. I hope she hasn't caused you any concern." "None at all," said the Beggar King. And then he said, so quietly Jordan was not even certain he heard it, "Heed me, friend, and soon, or I will carve you like one of your father's pieces of wood." "I swear he was that merchant we was talking about," Jack-Jack was saying. "I fancy a little box of salty nuts, I do."
Oh, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And you are here with at CITR 101.9 FM, and we were talking with Michelle Barker. Thank you very much for being on our show today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Conservation is the first and best resource option for BC. Do your part. Turn off the lights when you leave a room, and unplug your cell phone charger when charging is complete. Visit bchydro.com to find out more ways you can make a difference. This message brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
You are tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM in beautiful, if soggy, Vancouver. And we are about to hear something that is a bit of a treat and hasn't been on the radio for quite some time. Some of you out there in the Lower Mainland or wherever it is you're tuning in from might know the name Red Skelton. And if you don't, he was a very famous vaudeville comic, a famous radio personality, and a famous television personality. And he was one of the funniest people of the 20th century. And not a lot of people know about him anymore, which is a bit of a shame because he was from an era when comedy was built from the ground up with a lot of thought put into it in order to be really funny without resorting to the sort of flash that a lot of comedies in modern times seem to rely upon, especially comedies that are marketed towards very, very large audiences that we can think of at the drop of a hat. So, we are about to hear a treat. We are about to hear for the first time in probably a very long time, a rebroadcast of a public domain radio program that Red Skelton did back in the 1950s. And this is from his show. The title of this particular episode is People Who Brag. And it's about how parents talk about their kids, especially a couple of fathers talking about their kids. And you'll get to see that sometimes some things don't change. So sit back, relax, and take a listen to one of radio personality's great legends.
When Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean wide, you know what he told the Indians when he reached the other side? You won't know what you're missing if you don't see Nords.
Transcribed from Hollywood, Norge, a division of BorgWarner, manufacturers of America's most modern automatic and wringer washers, gas and electric ranges, water heaters, and home freezers. Originators and world's largest manufacturers of self-defrosting refrigerators, Norge presents the Red Skelton Radio Show. With Red Skelton, David Rose, and his orchestra, Loreen Tuttle, Pat McGee, and the Smith Twins will be me, Rod O'Connor. Now the star of our program, Red Skelton.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You know, I get a big kick out of being on just before Bing Crosby.
Yeah. They'll listen to the groaner, and now they're going to hear the moaner, huh?
Yeah. Man, how can you laugh when you've just been fired?
Look, just read what's there, bum. what's there ain't going to be there for you to read.
Oh. What'd you do today, Red?
Well, I spent the day with the kids while Georgia went shopping.
Was it boring?
No, I really enjoyed it myself.
I meant, was it boring for the kids?
I guess when I find them, I don't think they were bored with me. However, about an hour after I'd been with them, Valentina took Richard in the other room, and I heard her whisper to him, says, "Richie, you got to humor him along. Mm-hmm. He's not an Arthur Godfrey, but laugh at his jokes."
Well, how did you entertain your offspring?
Well, I spent the first hour telling them jokes, and in the second hour, I spent trying to wake them up. I don't know why Georgia has so much trouble getting them to take their nap. They doze right off on my third joke.
Well, didn't you play any games with them?
Oh, yeah, we played Tiddlywinks. I won 3 games in a row. That's before Richard caught me playing with loaded tiddlies. I said tiddlies, didn't I?
Yeah.
Then I fixed them their lunch.
You fixed lunch?
Yeah, I fixed lunch.
What did you serve them?
Liverwurst sandwiches and cold beer.
But Red, children don't drink beer.
They don't?
No.
Well, that explains why Valentina told me that they were on the wagon.
Oh.
She didn't want to hurt my feelings, I guess.
Oh, brother, you sure don't know much about how to handle kids, do you?
That's why I decided to spend more time with mine. You know, children nowadays are smarter than we were when we were kids. Why, when I was Valentina's age, I didn't know what 2 and 2 was.
What is 2 and 2?
Wait, I'll get a pencil for you. You know, Valentina and Richard are both in kindergarten this year. Mm-hmm. She's majoring in sandpile.
How about that?
Yeah, I'm a little disappointed. I was sort of hoping that she'd take up something more important, like bead stringing.
What does your boy want to be when he grows up? A comedian?
No, he wants to be just like his dad.
I thought he wanted to be a comedian.
You read my part, will you?
Well, now let's see. What does your boy want to be when he grows up?
He doesn't want to grow up. He likes it the way it is with me supporting him. I'm sure proud of him, though. I'm sure glad Sylvie and I had a child.
Every time I see her name, I always think it's saliva. Yeah, Roger says that the kid's a spitting image of her.
But I'm sure glad Sylvie and I had a child.
Are you expecting something else?
Say, Red, that reminds me. I want to show you a horse my boy drew the other day. Look at it.
That's a horse? Richard drew something that looked like that the other day, and only he called it an alligator.
Oh, go on. You're just jealous because my son is smarter than your son.
I don't like to brag about Richard, but let's face it, my kid's a genius.
My son can sing the Star Spangled Banner.
Now, you don't expect me to believe that.
Why not?
My kid hasn't finished writing it yet.
Oh, Red, we shouldn't brag about our kids.
Yeah,
like
I guess
this.
You're right. Let's talk about Mrs. Rose's son, David. He and his orchestra are going to play David's arrangement of The World is Waiting for the Sunrise. I should have said Sunset Bus.
Thank you.
Did you ever stop to think what a lot of gas it takes to keep the pilot light burning on your gas range 24 hours a day? Of course, if the only alternative was fumbling for matches, you'd choose the pilot light. But the new Norge self-starter gas range needs neither pilot lights nor matches. Electricity lights the gas. A tiny electric coil in the oven and another for the top burners lights the gas instantly at the touch of a button. And this thrifty, convenient Norge self-starter is so safe, it won this year's National Home Safety Award. The self-starter is only one of the extra value features you get in a new Norge gas range. The unusually roomy balanced heat oven is so expertly designed and insulated you can brown foods evenly any place at any temperature setting. Why, you can even bake six perfect cake layers at once. And Norge's famous spirulator burners actually cook faster with less gas. If you're even thinking about buying a new gas range, you'd better see the new Norge self-starter at your dealer's. Because you won't know what you're missing if you don't see Norge. From the Skelton Scrapbook of Satire, a story entitled People Who Brag. Chapter 1 is about a cowboy who never fired a gun but always shot off his mouth. Deadeye from Texas.
Come on, horse, boy! You keep going, boy. There's a glue factory just ahead there. All right, get your hoof out of my mouth.
Hey, did I?
Yeah.
There's the Wild Coyote Saloon we've been looking for.
Yeah, let's go over there. See if we can find that guy, Three Finger Jack. The guy who stole my gal and my gold down in Texas. I hope you're paying attention because this is the plot. Yes, sir. We're going to get that guy that stole my gal and my gold down in Texas. Take it or leave it. They sure are proud in this saloon, ain't they? That's my favorite song, Clara Balloon.
Say, did I? Look at that bartender. He looks mighty tough.
Yeah. He's even got muscles on his cow leg. I think I'll go over and sample the free lunch.
Oh, did you read that sign?
Free lunch, easy terms. Oh, well, I didn't want to disturb them flies anyhow.
You know something? I don't feel safe in here.
Don't worry. I can take care of myself. I'm from Texas. Feel the muscles in my arm.
Let me see.
Well, not so hard. You're making my ears puff up. Hey, bartender.
Yeah?
I'll have one of them rattlesnake frappes. Mm-hmm. And that's straight alcohol with a black widow spider riding the olive.
Okay, put that cigarette out before I pour it. Here you are.
Okay. Boy, I better hurry and drink it before it melts the glass. Well, up to the lips and over the gums. Look out, stomach, here she comes. Hey, bartender! Give me my chaser, will you, quick?
You just had your chaser. Here's your drink.
Never mind, I ain't got no stomach anymore.
Say, did I? Take a gander at that gal that just come out of that office.
Yeah, I did. She does look like a gander, don't she? Find out who she is. She's coming this way.
Well, that's what I get for washing my feet. Hello there, Paul, dark and bow-legged. Can I do anything for you?
You just did.
Well,
familiar, lady. Your name wouldn't have to be Susabel, would it? From Texas.
That's me in the flesh.
Sort of a loose fit, too, if you ask me. You're mighty pretty, though. There's something, suffocated about you. Something sophisticated about you. I guess it's the way you chew your tobacco.
Tell me, stranger, you a cow puncher?
No, I slap gophers. I work for a dairy farm, the one that has them contented cows.
Do tell.
Yeah.
What do you do there?
Oh, I just stand around, let the cows look at me. Makes them contented that they're cows. I'll tell you, the way the price of milk is now, them cows ain't contented. They're conceited.
Oh, Deadeye, you ain't changed a bit. You're still young and repulsive.
You told me, Deadeye. You recognize Miguel?
Yeah. I thought it was you when I first saw you. But it's been a long time since I jilted you.
Yeah. I ain't had a good jilting since. You jilted me about 8 years ago, didn't you, gal?
What have you been doing?
8 years. I got too old for good behavior, though.
You ain't sore, are you, did I?
Little saddle sore. I've been riding all day.
Well, I mean you ain't sore at me for throwing you over like I did.
No, I ain't mad. Just to show you there's no hard feelings, I brought you a present.
Oh, how lovely. What is it?
It's a pearl necklace. You like it?
Yeah. But shouldn't you have taken the pearls out of the oysters first?
Well, I didn't have the heart. You see, they weren't weaned yet. Say, tell me, is Three-Finger Jack here?
Oh, yes. But no trouble, Deadeye.
I'm out to get him, gal.
Deadeye. They're loading your gun.
Yeah, but I'm giving them a break. I'm using soft water.
No, Deadeye. Don't do it.
Don't hold me back. Let me go.
I'm not touching you.
Oh, I'm standing on my own tie. Stand aside, everybody.
Look, Deadeye, it's none of my business, but Three-Finger Jack is a tough hombre.
He don't scare me none. Where I come from, they're so tough. Anybody with a complete face is a tourist. Well, I've stalled long enough. Step aside, boys.
Who's there?
Can't you tell by my voice?
Yes, ma'am. Come in.
I hate these cramped quarters.
Howdy.
Howdy.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You forgot to close the door.
Yeah. Boy, what long arms I must have.
What's your complaint, cowboy?
Roulette. Table's downstairs. Don't look right to me.
Are you suggesting that roulette table is crooked?
No, you can't help it if a customer puts his money on the black or the red and the only color on the wheel is chartreuse.
And what are you clearing up my office for, Cactus Head?
I'm Deadeye.
You don't have to tell me. I'd recognize you with one eye closed.
You mean I'm only half safe?
You still think you're as tough as ever, don't you?
Yeah, I'm the roughest, toughest, most despicable hombre that ever defied the unconstitutional laws of the West.
Them's hard words.
I know, but I got them out.
I think you better leave now, Deadeye. This town ain't big enough for both of us.
Oh, it ain't, huh?
No, it ain't.
You mean that?
Yes, I mean it. This town ain't big enough for both of us.
It looks like I'm going to have to leave, don't it?
Now, look, Deadeye, I don't want any trouble. Here, take this $50,000 and get going.
Oh, no, you don't. I'm wise to that trick. I turned to go out, and you plugged me in the back and claim it was a robbery.
Where'd you learn that? From the Dalton brothers?
No, from the Warner brothers.
I warn you, Deadeye, I'm fast in the draw and I'm a good shot.
I'm a good shot, too. But I never use my shooting irons unless I really have to.
I'll give you a reason. Now reach for your shooting iron.
If you don't mind, I'll have to bend over. My pants just fell off.
Look, Deadeye, I was only kidding you. I'm giving you back everything I took from you. Here are the keys to the place. It's all yours, including the gal, Susie Bell.
I heard that. So you don't love me, eh, Three Finger? I'll show you, you two-timing snake in the sand.
Well, look at old Butterball Bounce. Susie Bell, I didn't know you could sew. Them's the best permanent buttonholes I ever saw. You sure are handy with them bullets.
Oh, did I? Nothing can ever keep us apart again.
Well, did I? There's the guy that cheated you, and you finally got the gal. What more do you want for complete happiness?
Just this.
Did
I? I think we got a customer. I knew this show was long, but I didn't think it was that long.
Did I? What have you done?
I just shot the guy that wrote this stuff.
Now the Smith Twins.
One day I went meandering to find myself a man. A handsome guy to share my kiss and love me when he can. The lonely steps to life I led began to get me down. I bought a dress and I confess I went running to town. I went meandering, meandering, looking far and wide for a man to stand beside. I went meandering, meandering, far from the old folks at home. I came across a handsome guy who said he loved me so, but he would bring his mother with us everywhere we go. I was so happy when he asked if I would be his wife, but when he told me that his ma would live with us for life, I went meandering, meandering, looking far and wide for a man to stand beside. I went meandering, meandering, far from the old folks at home. I met a wealthy fellow who was charming and divine. I kissed him once and then I knew I'd have to make him mine. I set the date and couldn't wait till he belonged to me. But when he told me I'd be wifey number 23, I went meandering, meandering, looking far and wide for a man to stand beside. I went meandering, meandering, far from the old folks at home. Far from the old folks at home. Far from the old folks at home.
Now for that weekly homemaker hint from Jane Masters, co-director of the Norge Home Economics Department.
Here's a trick to remember next time you cook rice. Grease the inside of the saucepan thoroughly with butter or margarine all the way to the top before you put in the boiling water and rice. The rice won't stick to the pan and it won't bubble over the top. And that reminds me, Rod, won't you tell our listeners how the Norge Spirulator burners help to keep pans clean on the outside?
It's a pleasure. Those Spirulator burners, exclusive with Norge, focus the flame like a spotlight under any size pan. So no matter how high you turn the gas, it never spills over the sides of your pans to make smudges that have to be cleaned off. Foods cook faster with less gas because all the heat is concentrated right where you want it. Norge's quick simmer safety valves provide any degree of heat instantly from a slow simmer to a fast boil. Get your Norge dealer to show you the beautiful new self-starter model, the gas range that lights electrically. You won't know what you're missing if you don't see Norge.
Our Our last chapter of People Who Brag is about a punch-drunk fighter by the name of Cauliflower McPug.
Oh, there's Cauliflower now boxing himself in front of a mirror. I better stop him before he hurts himself. Hey, Cauliflower.
Yeah, keep out of this, referee. Keep out of this. I just about got this bum licked. Oh, the bell saved him, boy.
Cauliflower, don't you know you're boxing a mirror?
Oh, I thought that guy had a glass jaw when I hit him there.
Hey, tell me, where'd you get the black eye in a fight?
Where'd you think I got it on a punch, boy? I got it in a bout last night at Pismo Beach. I was fighting a guy down there named Babyface Irving. We call him Babyface because he only got one tooth.
Did you win?
I don't know. They forgot to tell me when I came to. I should have won, but it was a bum decision, you know. They give it to the other guy on a technicality. Just because I was unconscious. How about that? I was unconscious. I was just acting normal.
Well, tell me, are you really a pugilist?
Good coming in.
Pugilist. P-U...
That's me.
Tell me, don't you think it's about time you hung up those gloves?
I might hang them up someday, yeah. Tom might get around to that. You know, don't worry about me. I'll quit before I get too many punches, you know. You can stay in the racket too long. Some guys stay in the ring until they start hearing bells and boys. Not me, no, boy. I will give up the old fight game before I start hearing bells and boys. Mm-hmm. Answer the phone.
Were you ever any good as a fighter?
If there's no phone in here, put one in before it stops ringing, will
you? Didn't answer my question.
What's that?
I say, were you any good as a fighter?
Oh, sure. I could have taken the middleweight crown, except I got some bad breaks.
What happened?
My jaw was broken 10 places.
You tell me about getting your jaw broken. Your jaw looks all right now.
Oh, except it should be below my lip. You know, some guy said that I might be another Jim Corbett.
Jim Corbett?
Jim Corbett. Mm-hmm. How about that? Me, another James Corbett. Jimmy Corbett, boy. How about that? Me. A Corbett. Who's Jim Corbett? You know, the other day I was doing, oh boy, a flock of them over that.
Have you had any fights this week?
Well, you didn't say that must be a pretty big fire.
What do you mean, big fire?
They've been going by all morning. What's that?
I said, have you had any fights this week?
Only with my wife. But I'm fighting her again next week. Mm-hmm. If I win, I get a shot at her mother on wrestling and television. Oh, God, dear. Where them Swiss bell ringers come from?
Tell me something, Cauliflower.
Oh, a flamingo!
Do you have any children?
I guess that's what you'd call them, yes. How about you?
Well, I have a little boy.
Do tell. You have a little boy?
Mm-hmm.
I got a little boy, too. Maybe it's the same kid. As my mother said when I was born, isn't this strange?
Oh, brother.
Oh, I didn't know we've related. Oh, mother.
Have you ever been knocked out by anybody in a fight, or have you ever knocked anybody out yourself?
Only once. I was swinging like a windmill, see, and I landed one right on its chin. And this guy was tricky, though.
Yeah?
Very tricky. He throws a terrific right, and I cleverly block it with my eye.
You say you landed one right on the guy's chin.
Right
you,
on his chin.
Was he surprised?
Wouldn't you be surprised to see a guy knock himself out? This guy would... Oh, take off your hat. They're towing a bell for Dumbarton.
Look, there aren't any bells ringing. There aren't any bells ringing.
You want to bet?
Sure.
Okay, the good humor man's coming. We'll let him hold the money.
You're punchy.
What's that?
You're punchy.
You think I've lost my marbles, huh?
Yeah.
You should see them guys down at that gymnasium. Oh, boy, them guys going. Poor Tucker, that rattler down there, especially. Every 2 minutes, he runs into the restaurant next door and orders Coca-Cola just so he can flirt with a pretty waitress in there.
Well, what's wrong with that?
There's no restaurant next to that gym. I know, I wash dishes.
Son of Flower, is there anybody you can lick?
I can lick any guy on the street. Anybody on the street.
I'll
boy,
bet.
Look at it, a pretty tough guy.
How about that guy standing over there? Can you lick him?
Well, that guy is a pretty big guy, ain't he? About 6 foot tall, weigh about 210 pounds. Oh, give me a break, boy. Give me something lighter,
Okay, how about that fella coming out of the drugstore?
Oh, 5'6" and weighs about 155 pounds with a mustache. He seems to be in a hurry. They're going back to Capistrano early, aren't they? Pick out something smaller, could you?
You see the Boy Scout helping that old lady across the street?
Hold my coat. You better hold that Boy Scout, too, because I don't want that old lady getting any help from me.
Oh, I'll see you later.
Yeah, I got to go weigh in for my bout tonight. I'll see you down at the gym.
The what?
The gym.
The gym?
Yeah, Jim Corbett. Who's Jim Corbett?
This is Rod O'Connor saying, remember, in refrigerators, home freezers, gas and electric ranges, washers and water heaters, everything Norge makes right. Make it a point to visit your Norge dealer soon. See the new Norge self-starter gas range, the range that doesn't waste gas on ever-burning pilot lights, but starts surely and safely with electricity. The range with a balanced heat oven that bakes evenly from corner to corner. The range with exclusive spirulator burners that focus the flame for faster, cleaner cooking. Yes, see the new self-starter gas range at your Norge dealers right away. And now until next week,
this is Red Skelton saying thanks for listening and reminding you that you won't know what you're missing if you don't see Norge.
Join us again next week for the Red Skelton Show. Red Skelton is heard in this program through the courtesy of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios. This is a copyrighted feature transcribed from Hollywood. This is the CBS Radio Network.
You are tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM, and this is Scald's Hall here in Vancouver. And a brief footnote to the drama you just heard. The Creative Commons license that allows us to broadcast them also says we cannot edit them. So that means we get to hear the time-capsuled show in toto, in its entirety, because the Creative Commons license that allows us to broadcast them does not allow us to edit them. So we get to hear the time-capsuled reports of commercials. And, of course, we're not the CBS. We are CITR 101.9 FM. Just to clear that up. Coming up in just a few moments, we will have Radio Zero and with Tyler and Cam. So don't go anywhere. Do not go away. Continue to sit back, relax, and enjoy your Friday afternoon.